Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hi, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to do another show number 34.
Yeah, moving right along.
We are.
Getting some exciting stuff today, the French Revolution and all
Oh,
that.
All right. Yeah. We've been anticipating it in several shows here, so what's leading up to it, and so here it is.
So we're going to talk a little bit about aristocratic bishops, some of those in France. One in particular was a real character. And then with that, sort of look at how the French Revolution came about.
Okay.
Okay. And just move right along with it.
That sounds great.
If you remember, Pope Gregory the 15th had done at least three very important things during his pontificate. The first being the setting the rules for the conclave, which they sort of followed more or less. That every pope sort of tweaks those rules a little bit here and there. And then secondly, establishing the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, which did an awful lot to spread the gospel worldwide. And then the third thing he did was he's the one who appointed Richelieu cardinal.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, making him the Bishop of Lucon and cardinal, of course, at the age of 22.
Oh my goodness! I didn't know it was that early.
Yeah, he was an incredible. He was a real workhorse, and by the age of 31, he was the Secretary of State for France.
Wow!
And for all practical purposes, was running the country, and certainly a thorn in the side of his own church. This is a man who, through his efforts as the Minister of State for France, favored the Protestants in Germany over the Habsburgs. In 1623, the Pope died, and of course cardinals were then brought to Rome for a new conclave. He declined going to the conclave, arguing that he was too busy. Mm. Isn't that something?
Maybe that was a good thing.
yeah, maybe it was a good thing, yeah. Pope Urban the Eighth was elected then at that particular conclave. The Pope then sent a message to Cardinal Richelieu asking him if, besides his other duties, if he would be the legate, the papal legate, to France. Because, I mean, already he was in the French government.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. He was too busy.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, this guy's a real character. You know? At one point, his anti-church activities were so extensive that Urban VIII actually considered excommunicating him and Louis XIII of France.
Wow.
Didn't do it, but almost there. So
that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it really is. There's another cleric who is worthy of our attention also. He's sort of buried beneath the surface, but his life sort of tells us a little bit about aristocrats and them using church positions. Not everyone was a saint, obviously, in the church, and some of them used the church in order to get further ahead. His role in the church is an abbé. He's not an abbot. An abbé is it was a level of before ordination. It was actually the level before subdeacon.
Oh, okay.
So it's a ministry within the church, but it's a very low level ministry.
Okay.
Anyway, his name is François Joachim de Pierre de Bernay. Okay, and at the age of 12, he was with his family and joked about having a vocation. And the family was so upset they sent him to a seminary.
Okay.
Here you go. We'll show you. At the age of 19, he is elevated to the position of abbé. That's A-B-B-E with an accent aigu over the E, which is, I say, a position below subdeacon. Shortly after that, he was expelled from Saint-Sulpice Seminary. If you remember when we were talking about Saint-Sulpice, I mentioned that there was a young man.
Who ate a chicken?
Who ate a chicken. This is the guy.
Okay.
He was eating a roasted chicken in bed, and that got him tossed out of the seminary, which he was perfectly happy with. But the family was very upset. And so he was cut off from his family. They had nothing to do with him. He had nothing to do with the church at this point. And so he went to Paris, and basically he honed his skills as a flirt.
Okay.
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 He used his good name. He used his family background, his aristocratic ways. And he then basically spent time then just going from party to party and flirting with people and making his way that way. That turned out to be a very valuable asset for him, because not only did he flirt, but he also knew how to bring people together.
Okay.
And he became something of a matchmaker
in
Paris. People just knew that Debarnay was the man to turn to if you were looking for a spouse or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or something like that. And he begins making all these arrangements. And these are very high, important people.
Uh-huh.
His real claim to fame came when he introduced the king, Louis the 15th, introduced the king to Madame de Pompadour, who shortly after became the king's mistress.
Oh, okay.
And Louis was so grateful to Debarnay for having done this that he gave him a reward by making him the ambassador, the French ambassador, to Venice.
Okay.
And that's a nice plum.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he ships off down to Venice, gets there, and immediately Debarnay realizes that there is a lot of tension in Venice because of misunderstandings and difficulties between the church, between the Papal States, and the city of Venice itself. These are two relatively small Italian principalities. And what he did was he used his skills of being a matchmaker to patch up the differences between the Papal States and the city of Venice.
Wow, okay.
And for that, he was again rewarded.
Uh-huh.
And this time around, the church then rewards him and says basically to Debarnay, what would you like? And he said to the bishop in Venice, he said, I'd love to become a subdeacon. I'd love to have that advancement beyond abbe. Well, he was not sincere on this, but the bishop didn't know that. And so he was then given the title of subdeacon. Now, of course, this is not exactly the ordination, but anyway, it's subdeacon. His response afterwards to the bishop was this: now I can sing the song of Simeon. Now, he didn't mean the song of songs.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Simeon is simony.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, the implication is now I can commit simony. But obviously, this is a man who is just simply, has no faith himself.
Right.
Well, he returns back to France now, and he goes back and he becomes the foreign minister of France. Okay, so that's the Secretary of the Foreign Ministry. And once again, he receives more rewards. Although he is obviously uses the church and his church position, at the same time, he also uses his position as foreign minister to advance the cause of the church in a number of ways. And Pope Benedict the 14th sent a letter to Louis the 15th, the King of France, and said, I'd like to reward Debarnay in some way, and I think I would like to make him a cardinal. And Louis the 15th wrote a letter back to the Pope saying, that's a wonderful idea, I think he'd make an excellent cardinal. The only ones that objected to Debarnay becoming a cardinal were Louis the 15th's mistresses, and he had a bevy of them, and they were all upset because of various reasons and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, these girlfriends at Versailles put the pressure on Louis the 15th, who then squashes the announcement of Debarnay being made a cardinal. Debarnay knew about this correspondence, and so what he did then was he simply went public himself.
Oh.
And he says, I understand that the king has received a letter from the Pope naming me to become a cardinal. And it was all over France. Well, what can you do?
Clarity. Okay.
And so, sure enough, he got his way. He became a cardinal. But Louis the 15th
didn't know how to work it, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But Louis the 15th was so upset over this that he made him a cardinal and then kicked him out of Versailles.
Uh-huh.
And he went into exile.
Mm-hmm.
So there he is, you know, sitting with the cardinal's hat, but in exile, and everyone against him except the queen. Now, the reason why Queen Marie was in favor of Duvernay was because...
I think I got this one, because the mistresses.
Yeah, that's right. This is, you know, what can I say? This is Versailles at its best.
The West Wing.
Well, it looked as though Duvernay was going to spend the rest of his life languishing, because the queen didn't have a heck of a lot of clout either. However, he continues his matchmaking ways, and he finds a way to get word to Louis the 15th that there is a young lady that he just has to meet. She is just the most wonderful thing in the world. And so Louis the 15th sort of forgives him a little bit, and Cardinal Duvernay introduces the King of France, Louis the 15th, to Madame du Barry, who becomes one of his mistresses also. But Madame du Barry is a very devout Catholic, daily communicant.
Okay.
Now, remember that when we're talking about mistresses here, we're talking basically about companions, whether or not there was... I'm not going to whitewash this and say that, you know, it was platonic, but on the other hand... And she does a lot, actually, to influence the king to become more religious toward the last years of his life, which is no easy task.
I would assume.
Well, in exchange now for having done this wonderful thing, Duvernay is now made an archbishop of the Diocese of Albi, which was a very wealthy diocese. Okay. It was the third wealthiest in France after Paris and Lyon. And in 1769, he then, as a cardinal, travels to Rome for the conclave of 1769. When he gets there, remember the dietary rules that had been set up by Gregory the 15th, remember that you'd have a nice meal, and then the day after that, it'd be more simple and more simple.
Right,
simple.
For the conclave,
Yeah, and as the conclave wore on day after day, the papal meals got more and more simple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that Cardinal Duvernay simply cheated.
Mm-hmm.
He had caterers bringing in meals into his apartment, and then he would invite the other cardinals to come over for a snack. And of course, they were these big, scrumptious banquets. And
he didn't learn much from seminary, did he?
No, you know, roast chicken all over again. And one of those, as he was getting to know the other cardinals, and, you know, in the conclave, there's all the talk that goes on and the consultations and the prayer and all this. He comes across one in particular, a Franciscan, who is at the time was serving in the Holy Office. His name is Lorenzo Ganganelli. And after a month... Of no vote, no successful vote, Duvernay begins zeroing in on this Franciscan, asking him lots of questions, and one of the things he found out was that that he was somewhat pro-Spanish and at the same time had anti-Jesuit ideas, was concerned about the Jesuits being too powerful, and so Duvernay feels that this might be the man that they need. And so what he did was he worked all night long, never went to sleep that night, going from cardinal to cardinal, trying to persuade them to vote for Ganganelli, which they did the next day. And he won the election. He becomes then Pope Clement the 14th.
Okay.
Louis the 15th loved it. He was so happy that this man became pope. And then to find out, of course, that... Cardinal Duvernay had something to do with this. And so as a result, he then made him the French ambassador to the Papal States. Okay. So, he has this as well as being a cardinal, as well as being the Archbishop of Albi, You know, he's got mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. But he's a very, very hard worker. But it turns out that that Pope Clement is not his toady.
Uh-huh.
And Clement, simply when he became Pope, his opinion of the Jesuits changed somewhat.
Okay.
And he believed that the Jesuits could be reformed,
mm-hmm.
and that it wasn't necessary to suppress them, which is what he was thinking beforehand. So he really resists this until incredible pressures from Spain, Portugal, France, some of the Italian states, and finally he is going to be forced to do that in 1773. Pope Clement then will close down the Society of Jesus. This is a quote that he said, and you can almost hear the regret in his own voice. He said, "Under the pressure of the unjust and the envious secular forces of the times, in a sea of dark foreboding, a father's hand sacrifices the Society of Jesus for the tranquility of the bark of Peter."
Wow.
Isn't that something? So there it happens. That's 1773. 1774, Louis the 15th dies. So did Clement the 14th.
Okay.
The next conclave that's going to come along, the master of this conclave, the guy that's actually running everything and putting on big banquets again, is Cardinal de Bernini. Yeah, he's just a real character. He eventually will help to get another Vatican official elected the next pope. He is an official in the Vatican Treasury. Sharp fellow, Pius V.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Pius VI.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Pope Pius VI. Time is running out,
mm-hmm.
and certainly running out for all of these people. In 15 years, you'll have the Estates General called. 4 years after that, the king himself, the next king, will be guillotined.
Mm-hmm.
De Berny, the king, all of they're all doomed. It's mm-hmm. like they're shifting chairs on the Titanic,
right?
Without even realizing what was about to happen. This particular conclave is interesting in itself. It went on for 4 months.
Wow, in Pius VI's election.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's going to be a struggle between two groups of cardinals.
Okay.
And one group is called the Zelanti, and this group of cardinals are religiously devout, interested in the discipline within the church. They are also concerned about the Jesuits having been suppressed, and they're interested in reviving the Society of Jesus with certain reforms to take mm-hmm. place. So that was that one group. On the other side, and this will be, these are cardinals who come from the aristocracy for the most part, and these are known, that this particular group is known as the courtiers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so the two go back and forth, and there's a long time. It's only in February of 1775 that they finally end up with a candidate. He is himself going to be a rigorist. As I mentioned, he's a Vatican official. This is Cardinal Angelo Bracci. Just a phenomenal character. He's from Cesena,
okay.
You know, in Italy. At the age of 17, he got his first law degree.
Wow.
17 years old. He's a very serious young man, secretary to his local bishop. He was ordained at 38, which is relatively old mm-hmm. for then, and as I say, becomes then a Vatican financial officer, and in 1775 then is elected Pope Pius the Fifth. He is going to have lots and lots of problems. He is going to have a difficult life, and finally, in the way that he dies, is nothing short of heroic. He is, I would say, the beginning of a whole series of incredible popes that this church has had over the last 200 years.
Yes.
And he's going to be the first, and he actually backs into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was not a great man until he was made pope. And even after pope, he was sort of I can't say worldly, but he was very concerned about himself. And as time went on, he developed in a sense, then developed as a father to the church. He really becomes the Holy Father.
Yes.
And in some ways, through incredible personal humiliation.
Hmm.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about about that a little bit later. But anyway, I'd like to go ahead and start looking at this class of people that we've been talking a little bit about, and the role, especially in the 1700s, that the aristocrats play. It's just really fascinating because I think most historians who look at the French Revolution, as they look at the coming of the French Revolution, would say that the first phase of the French Revolution was actually caused by the aristocrats themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always tend to, we have these pictures, this Hollywood picture of the storming of the Bastille, and you know, it's the urban masses rising up against the aristocrats and all that. The fact of the matter is, it's quite different. So, just a look at that. In the 1700s, there was a real sense in Europe of an identity of belonging to what they referred to as bodies. They referred to themselves as a constituted body.
Okay.
Basically, it's an organization or it's a sense of class.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. In some cases, it's a question of a trade. You know,
uh-huh.
We've seen unions,
mm-hmm.
of course, all throughout, going back, the guilds and unions in the Middle Ages.
Sure.
So there was always that sense there. In some cases, it's a question of careers or occupations, of function. There was a sense of unity among certain government officials, like the intendant, had a sense of themselves. Judiciaries, like the parlement in various parts of France, had a sense of that. The clergy had a sense of itself as
mm-hmm.
being belonging to a particular group. It might be a similar interest. So textile owners or shipping magnates just sort of came about themselves. Ever since the Middle Ages, France especially, but other countries also, had a sense of these, which they referred to as orders or estates.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all familiar, if you study anything about the period, you know about the three estates, the estates general, the three estates. The first estate being the clergy, the church. The second estate being nobles, and then the third estate basically being everybody else beyond that. As we look at the church itself in France in the 1700s, that sense of belonging to an estate is both real constitutionally. There's no written constitution, but there's a sense of it, and it's perceived. You know, people see themselves. It's made up of bishops and cardinals and abbots, and it's also made up of the diocesan clergy. It's made up of religious orders, the regular clergy, in the monks in monasteries, the nuns in convents, the mendicants, the communal houses of religious orders. We've seen, of course, in the 1600s, the 1500s and 1600s, the incredible growth of so many saints founding so many orders, and these orders are still around. They're still doing much of the work that we would consider today to be the work of the secular government.
Mm-hmm.
Education, hospitals, caring for the poor, all those sorts of things. That was all being done by this literally an army, a myriad of religious men and women who gave their lives over to Christ and service to their fellow man. Yeah. The second estate, this is the group that really has a sense of itself more than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the nobles.
Mm-hmm.
These are the nobles. However, interestingly enough, you begin hearing the term aristocrat used more than noble, and there's a slight difference between the two.
Yeah.
You know, nobles, these are nobles with an attitude.
Uh-huh.
You could refer to a noble back in the Middle Ages, and he might be a rough, tough, smelly guy with a great big beard and a strong arm from using a sword and all of that. Or he could be a courtier, mm-hmm. Dressed in leotards and mm-hmm. speaking Latin with a lisp or whatever. So a noble would be very wide-ranging. In the 1700s, when you talk about aristocrats there, it's more of a way of life. It's mm-hmm. a way of carrying yourself. An example of that are the English aristocrats. Interestingly enough, in England in the 1700s, there were only 200 nobles.
In
all of England.
Okay.
But there were literally thousands of aristocrats. The French used to make fun of that. They referred to these thousands of Englishmen who would travel Europe, and they referred to them as milords anglais, the English milords, uh-huh. And the idea behind that was that they could put on airs,
uh-huh.
and this is exactly what these aristocrats were doing. Now, there are two ranks, if you could say,
mm-hmm.
of aristocrats, and the more common is the one that is a combination of several things. First of all, good birth.
Okay,
you have to be born. A friend of mine refers to it as the gene pool lottery. if you're lucky enough to be born in that family,
uh-huh.
well, then you're on your way. You're
uh-huh.
not necessarily set,
right.
but you're on your way. Second is education, and I don't
uh-huh.
mean that in the formal sense. I mean in an informal sense. It has to do, in the broadest sense, it has to do with breeding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a development of character. Or in some cases, in the case of de Bernay, development of personality
mm-hmm.
rather than character,
mm-hmm.
So it's the way that you carry yourself. De Bernay is a great example of this. Here's a man who, as a teenager, was kicked out of the seminary. That ended his formal education.
Uh-huh.
But his informal education was, he really honed his skills
uh-huh.
at diplomacy and at interpersonal relations at the salons in Paris. That's where his real education came. And the way he carried himself then is very aristocratic.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with dress, the way you dress.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
mm-hmm.
saying you hear all the time that you dress up to your next job.
Right.
So you always dress a little bit nicer. It has to do with the way you speak.
Uh-huh.
What's the hooked on phonics thing? If people judge you by the way you speak. Well.
Uh-huh.
Well, the words you use, well, they do. And so all of those things are added to that, too. An example of this I came across as I was doing some reading in preparation for all of this was a comment made by Albert Gallatin.
Uh-huh.
Now, Albert Gallatin is the Secretary of Treasury to Thomas Jefferson during his administration.
Oh, okay.
He's from Switzerland. Okay, and his grandfather... is Swiss, rather wealthy, and owned land in France across the border.
Okay.
In 1789, his grandfather served in the Estates General, representing the Second Estate as a nobleman. Now here he is, a wealthy Swiss businessman,
mm-hmm.
but because he carried himself the way he did, and he owned French property, he was immediately accepted into the aristocracy of France.
Mm-hmm.
His grandson wanted nothing to do with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he could, he left home, made his own way over to America, where he was involved with the American Revolution and American government, and serving, as I say, in the administration, the Jefferson administration.
Mm-hmm.
He could have gotten to America a lot easier. His grandfather had offered to buy him a commission in the Hessian army. And he decided to come over on his own and get on the other side,
mm-hmm.
thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one rank that you see.
Okay.
There's another rank also, and that's made up. It's actually a closed hierarchy that is based upon function.
Oh, okay.
You know, so for instance, an example of this would be if we had a United States senator, okay, mm-hmm. and there are only, you know, 100 of them, so mm-hmm. that's a pretty rarefied thing. But if the U.S. senator were to get into his automobile and drive down a highway, he is now simply a driver.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Uh-huh,
you know?
Okay.
You take a general in the Army, okay, or an admiral in the Navy. Okay, that's a very rarefied position.
Right.
You know, they have lots of authority.
Uh-huh.
But if he goes into a store and is shopping for groceries, he's simply a shopper.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
he's simply so it everything in that kind of hierarchy is based upon role and rank.
Okay.
And it has to do with the functions itself. That's the kind of hierarchy, the kind of aristocracy, which even Democrats, small d, would respect.
Okay.
Great quote from Thomas Paine in his book, The Rights of Man. And he says this, I'm paraphrasing here. He says, if a man is called a judge or a general, we know what he is and what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if he's called a duke or a count, we have no idea what he is or what he does. He could be a man or he could be a baby.
Uh-huh.
You see?
Uh-huh.
So that first order, that mm-hmm. first rank of aristocrats is resented by
okay.
lots and lots of people.
Uh-huh.
And but the second is easily accepted.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the two mingle together, personality and title, what we find in the 1700s is that in many cases now, as they mingle together, they're welded into one by something called money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, interestingly enough, one of the critics of the aristocracy of this century is himself a member of the aristocracy. His name is Jacques Turgot. And he was at one time the chief economist for both Louis XV and Louis XVI.
Okay.
He got fired by Louis XVI, but he was a baron himself. You know, he was educated at Saint-Sulpice
mm-hmm.
and went there for the education, not for the priesthood. After he finished, isn't that an incredible school, by the way? I mean, every time you turn around, you're coming
somebody
across.
Somebody graduated from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either that or got kicked out of there.
Kicked out of there, right.
And then went on to study at the Sorbonne.
Uh-huh.
And he's a very, okay. very bright man. And he was very, very critical of this idea of money creating aristocrats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, setting up class warfare. This is a quote from Jacques Turgot. He said the following. He said, another reason operates to render privilege most unjust and at the same time less worthy of respect. Where nobility can be acquired by the payment of money, there is no rich man that does not speedily become a noble, so that the body of the nobles includes the body of the rich, and the cause of the privileged is no longer the cause of distinguished families as opposed to the common classes, but rather the cause of the rich against the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, which one has all the clout? The rich. And the rich are going to make some richer and make the poor poorer. And so the whole concept, although it's more an ideal than a lived reality, of a society that cooperates together, the three estates,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in the mind of and in the sociology, if you could call it that, of St. Thomas Aquinas, there is that relationship in society in which each part helps the other.
Mm-hmm.
This breaks down in when you have a class of people, the aristocrats of the 18th century, that are looking out for their own class interests. When they do that, they'll create problems with the other classes and drive them. Well, ultimately, you're going to end up looking at Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to, you know, come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
The kings, Louis XV and Louis XVI, Louis XV better, and Louis XVI wasn't as good at this, used the noble class. as a result, in many cases, the two ranks, those who are born into privilege and those who have this hierarchy of function, then are welded together into one. They use them as ambassadors, in many cases, military governors of various colonies, in some cases, simply as courtiers at Versailles. And that continues also as Louis the 16th becomes king also. There are literally tens of thousands of these in France. Now remember I'd mentioned that there are only 200
in England.
Nobles in England. There are tens of thousands of nobles or aristocrats in France. And they really, in many ways, are a parasite. True, many of them are doing functions. But also, all of them are tax-free.
Oh,
they don't pay any taxes.
God.
They're property. They don't pay any property tax. And in the 1700s, they have a strong sense about themselves. As I say, there's a class consciousness amongst themselves in which they are trying to squeeze out non-nobles out of other positions.
Oh, uh-huh.
The army is a good example of that. Louis XIV really creates the first modern army.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis XV inherits this and he improves on it. And Louis XVI is going to do the same. We're going to be the beneficiaries of that here in the United States when they ship an entire French army over toward the end of the war, and they participate in the Battle of Yorktown with the Americans in helping to win that. General Rochambeau, who is also a nobleman, and the admiral of the French fleet, which blocked the British from getting into saving Cornwallis, who was Admiral de Grasse, who was also a nobleman. And so was Cornwallis, and Lord Cornwallis. So in all the generals fighting at the Battle of Yorktown, there was only one non-nobleman, George Washington.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But here's an interesting fun fact I came across. In 1750, there were 4,000 officers, even up into generals, who were from the bourgeoisie,
wow,
from the middle class. Yeah. By 1781, there were no new officers being made from the bourgeoisie. You had to be a nobleman, an aristocrat, to be made an officer. And in 1781, that's only 8 years before the revolution that takes place, the French Revolution, they succeeded in getting the king to accept the principle that no non-noble or aristocrat would be an officer in the French army. The king insisted on a grandfather clause in which those officers who were of the bourgeoisie would remain and keep their commission, but upon their retirement, they would be replaced by an aristocrat. The idea being that within about 20 years, it would be an entirely aristocratic run army.
Okay.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You know, and as we look around, the other great institution in France is the church.
Mm-hmm.
There are 135 bishops. By 1789, every one of those bishops is from the aristocracy.
Wow.
You know. So the whole idea of holiness is kind of out the window.
Right.
I mean, that's fine for nuns and priests and monks and all, but the leadership of the church in France, it's going to be the nobles who are going to find that. And so you have people like de Bernis, who is not qualified religiously to
right.
be a cardinal or a bishop, but is going to have that position because of his noble bearing and
mm-hmm.
his connections with powerful people. There's this class consciousness then is going to trickle down into the church itself.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that that the priest will have the country priest will have great respect for his bishop because of his title, you know, as bishop. So that's the functional hierarchy. but personally, they're going to be of two different classes of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there'll be that difference. a real insight into what was going on in the church itself right before, on the eve of the revolution, really has to do with a gathering of the clergy from all over France that takes place in 1765. It was called the Assembly of the Clergy, and I believe it's the last time they meet as a body prior to the French Revolution. I'm not aware of another meeting after that.
Mm-hmm.
But what comes out of that meeting, now here we have a gathering of all the bishops of France, of representatives of the various monasteries, of the religious orders, the priests themselves. So they all gather, and they're basically dealing with two big issues. And the first issue they have to deal with is the philosophes.
Okay.
You know, this is that group that is heading France towards secularism.
Mm-hmm.
It's anti-clerical. And so the very first thing they began dealing with is the question of the secularization of France.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a very serious issue, and they deal with this. They're concerned about this. So it's not that you have a group of clergy that are that have tin ears
mm-hmm.
to what's going on in society. They certainly mm-hmm. are attuned to that. The other thing they were very concerned about was Jansenism.
Oh, right.
It was still around, you know, and they were particularly concerned that the Jansenists, first of all, they were very respected by the French people in general, because they were very hardliners, very rigorous in their own particular lifestyle. And but what concerned the clergy was not so much the fact that they lived a holier than thou lifestyle. That's bad enough, but you know, and constantly shoving it down people's throats. But the way that they approached the sacraments was in very, very rigorous. And so you had within those groups of Jansenist Catholics a very sparse use. People did not come to the Eucharist. You know, they went to Mass, but they didn't receive the Eucharist.
Right.
They denied themselves. See, they're denying themselves of the graces of the sacraments. Then you have to start wondering, what was their theology
mm-hmm.
behind? I mean, what did they understand the sacraments to be if they were not making use of them? There was a real concern, because if you get below that surface, you begin finding that their theology is heavily Calvinist.
Oh, okay.
You know, so mm-hmm. what's the difference between a Huguenot mm-hmm. and a Jansenist Catholic then?
Mm-hmm.
You know? The second thing that the Jansenists were very upsetting to the clergy was that they were very critical of the lifestyle of the bishops. You know?
Uh-huh.
Now, seen in the context, here's 135 bishops. All of them are from aristocratic backgrounds. So the way that they're raised, the breeding,
mm-hmm.
you know, once again, the education that they had, is going to lead them in a particular way to speak in a particular fashion, to carry themselves in a particular fashion, to dress in a particular fashion, and that's not going to be the way that the common people act. And so it really sets the bishops in France up for a real fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about some of the bishops here in America, and some of them were French.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about Bishop Dubourg,
uh-huh.
you know, and he carried himself as a gentleman, and he was very respected, but he wasn't aristocratic about it. You know, and
right.
he could, and bishop after bishop in America, they were men of the people, even if they came from aristocratic backgrounds.
Uh-huh.
This is not true of many of the,
what's going
on? You know, in France.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then, of course, the other thing that the Jansenists, that they were concerned about was that they had a very strong anti-papal stance. They're part of that group of people who want to decentralize
mm-hmm.
The church all the more. Now, many of the bishops had some sympathy with that, because they had a tendency to be Gallicanists themselves, but the Jansenists carried this too far.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, the reaction was this. The meeting that took place in 1765, the clergy voted then to begin a process in which every Catholic in France would receive a certificate to receive the sacraments.
Wow. Okay.
It was called the billet de confession. Okay, the bulletin of a confession. And what it was a certificate by a bishop or a priest that this individual was not, it did not have Jansenist leanings. Okay? So that if you got married, give an example of it, if you were getting married in a particular church, besides all the other paperwork that has to be done, the bride and the groom would have to present to the priest that was going to be officiating at the wedding a billet de confession, which would show that the individual is a bona fide Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's how they were going to go about doing this, and so they voted on it and it passed, and so they began printing up the BAs. Well. The courts in Paris, where the meeting took place, it's a little confusing. The court systems, I have to put that in the plural, the court systems in France were called parlement.
Okay.
It's different from the parliament in England, of course.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the courts in Paris, the parlement of Paris, nullified this rule. They simply said, you are not allowed to print out and to use these certificates, and how can you do that? Remember, there's no separation of church and state.
Exactly.
And so the bishops then had to appeal this to the king.
Okay.
And Louis XV then overrules the Parlement and says yes, they will be using the billet de confession in the future. This was roundly criticized. This particular act was roundly criticized by an interesting group of very strange bedfellows. On the one hand, you had the Jansenists, who you would understand would be upset about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they were joined by a group that had no respect for the Jansenists, and the Jansenists had no respect for them, the philosophes.
Mm-hmm.
They're arguing that it's a collusion between the church and state, that the government is being heavy-handed, that the church hierarchy is being heavy-handed, and it's just one more example of the oppression of the people by this cabal between the two groups. Other parlements in France also did the same thing. So the king had ordered the Parlement of Paris to stand down. Okay, he didn't say anything about Lyon,
no.
About Marseille, Bordeaux, Nice. I mean, you go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to fight in the courts. Every court,
mm-hmm.
And there were hundreds of these parlements. And so he had that to worry about. Ultimately, what happened is that the BA, de confession, drove the Jansenists then underground.
Mm, okay.
And so they were all the more anti-church and all the more anti-monarchy. By and large, the Jansenists in France in the 1700s are for the most part middle class. They're urban middle class.
Mm-hmm.
They are moderately educated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, think in terms of a merchant, and he sends his children, he sends boys particularly, to a school, to the parish school, and they're there until about 13, 14 years old. Maybe they're taught by the Frères des Écoles Chrétiennes, the Christian brothers, and they learn how to read and write and do their arithmetic, and they learn some catechism and all those sorts of things. And then at 13 or 14 years old, they're brought out of the school and they're sent to work in dad's business, maybe as a bookkeeper.
Okay.
You know. And so as they get older and eventually they'll marry and have their own family and all that, that's the extent of their education.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are they reading? In many cases, they're going to be reading a sort of watered-down version of what the philosophers are writing. So this is the stuff that they're going to be coming in contact with. The devout Jansenist is going to be caught between the church on the one side, the Roman Catholic Church, and on the other side, the secular bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to find himself, and when we're coming up to the revolution itself, he's going to find himself in a in a position in which other people of his class, they'll be meeting over a business deal or something, and these others in his group will begin criticizing the church, which he'll join in, and then they'll be criticizing Christianity, which he won't join in for, but he'll find himself in a very compromised position. And there is a strong tendency now at this point among this semi-educated bourgeois class of abandoning the Catholic faith. Mm. They are simply not going to. They'll be Catholic in the sense that they will have been baptized, probably married in the church, intending to be buried from the church, but there's no living faith in them. It's a whole generation of this particular class that is going to instead base themselves upon what you could call reasoned morality. And I've got a wonderful quote here that sort of explains this. Basically, they want to keep religion because they believe religion is good for our society.
Okay.
But there's no living faith.
Right.
You know?
Right.
This particular quote that I have comes from Bernard Grothuysen, and he wrote a book back in the 1920s called The Bourgeois, Catholicism versus Capitalism in 18th Century France.
Okay.
It was reissued in 1968, but I think it's out of print now.
Okay.
But he's got some really interesting insights into this generation of people, this particular class and generation of people that has lost their faith.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be the grist for the anti-Catholicism, anti-Christianity that takes place during the French Revolution that leads to the deaths of so many priests and nuns and devout Catholics, and the establishment of the state church and all of those sorts of things. But listen to what he says. He says, we should therefore recognize the utility of religion. Utility? The rich had property which religion protected far better than could any emancipated morality. And he quotes a Swiss financier who actually replaced Turgot as the French financial minister for a while, till he got fired too. His name is Jacques Necker. And this is what he says. This is right from the mouth of a horse.
Okay.
He says this, God, giving his law on Mount Sinai, has only to say thou shalt not steal. And with the exalted idea of this God, this commandment, preserves sufficient authority for all times. But if a political philosophy says, thou shalt not steal, it must add to that precept a series of arguments on the laws of property, on the inequality of conditions, and on the various relations of the social order. The author then reflects on this and says this, it was therefore much safer to stick with religion and to entrust the defense of property to God
mm-hmm.
rather than philosophy.
Uh-huh.
In other words, give the poor their religion and it'll keep them in line. And these are words coming from people that have no faith. You know, it's not a question of losing the faith at the time of the French Revolution. The people who led the French Revolution had no faith at all. If they used faith, they did it in order to keep the poor poor. Remember, even Voltaire erected a church on his property, not for himself,
but for his servants.
For his servants.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them in line. Yeah. So this is really what's going to be setting us up as we go into the French Revolution and the events that take place. And seen from that point of view, we can have, I think, a better understanding of why. That helps us to understand the difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American Revolution was a deeply religious revolution. Nowadays, you know, you don't hear that, especially in our textbooks. And in the schools. But the fact of the matter is that there was a tremendous, it was a faith-filled revolution. The whole founding of this country, the coming of colonists to this country was mainly religiously motivated. That's a very, very different motivation than what's going to come out of the French Revolution.
Uh-huh.
And the French Revolution is going to truly, truly be the first attempt at secularizing society and trying to recreate society based upon the secular ideals of the philosophers.
Alright.
So there.
Very interesting look at that. And so next week we'll pretty much begin.
We'll get right into it.
Yeah,
we'll start off with the meeting at Versailles.
Okay.
With the Estates General.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how the aristocrats, through their use of class warfare, in a sense, win, and then how they lose almost immediately, within a couple weeks. And then you'll see the constant devolution, class by class by class, until you get down to the lowest, which is demagogues,
mm-hmm.
who are going to be whipping up mobs. And the ugly side of the French Revolution comes out.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Father. Shall we close with prayer?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was
in the beginning,
is
now, and
ever
shall
be.
A world without end.
Amen. Thank you, Father.